This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Dr. Denison Jayasuriya is a sociologist, social advocate, and most recently co-author of Faith and Society, My Life Journey and Thoughts, which was launched on September 3rd, coinciding with his 60th birthday. I'm pleased to have Dr. Denison here in the studio with me to talk about the book he co-wrote with his wife, as well as how his thoughts about Malaysian society has evolved over the years. So, Dr. Denison, why did you decide to write a memoir now?
I think 60 years is, very important period or a milestone in one's life. And my wife had been encouraging me to pen out the experiences over the six decades of my life, the life journey, as well as the things I have advocated in public as a public intellectual.
The title of your book is Faith in Society, but with the wealth gap widening and extremist rhetoric making headlines every now and then, and perhaps even more frequently in recent times, what should communities who feel marginalized put their faith in?
Okay. I think I took the title for two reasons. Firstly, it was my own faith. I am a Christian and I used to be working full-time with the church before. It's my faith that took me into society to work alongside the poor, the disadvantaged. But at the same time, I have confidence that our society are citizens of Malaysia who are actually very reasonable people and people who have goodness and wanting to build a better Malaysia. There might be sections of the society or groups that might sound extremist of some kind, but on the whole, majority we find that our neighbours, our people living, are peace-loving, and Malaysians are quite a pleasant group to live along with. I think on the issue of poverty and inequality and rising inequality in society, that's largely part of the development paradigm Malaysia has adopted, in which the top 20% have benefited much more and the bottom 40% are not moving as high, although they have moved out of the poverty line. And that is something I think through the economic development policies and social policies, we would then see greater social inclusion. And this is something that must be of great concern to the government. And I've addressed those pockets of disadvantaged groups, whether they are the interior forest-based communities, rural poor like the fishing community, or those in some kampongs or in the interior, as well as displaced plantation workers in the urban setting living in high-rise flats. So we might not have the kind of income deprivation, but the total in comparison to others within the socio-economic bloc, we are then seeing sections that are left behind. And this is a major area of concern as we seek to move forward as a developed society. And we are just 6 years away from Vision 2020.
What would it take to bring the disenfranchised back into the fold?
Okay. I think a lot of focus in development planning has often been on socio-economic, education, and so forth. I think this is important. Malaysia has played the right focus on education, healthcare, rural development, improving investment and jobs, and so forth. But that's only one half. The other half is actually civil and political rights as well. And the great economist Amartya Sen, in various of his writings, have called for this balance between socio-economic development and civil and political rights. So it's only when the poor are empowered to participate in the decision-making, then we will see greater social cohesion. The grievances are from sections at the bottom, whether they are forest-based communities, like the indigenous people, like the Orang Aslis, or the Sabahans and the Sarawakians, or other urban poor who are disadvantaged, also due to lack of local government elections. They are in high-rise flats. The access to the type of services in their neighborhoods are not comparable to that of rural communities. And so along with economic empowerment and improvement of income levels, education, healthcare, we need to balance it with civil and political rights. And in this context, we are a bit weak on participatory development. A lot of our development tends to be top-down, but I think the kind of reaction we are seeing in urban areas, seen from the voting pattern, it's not just looking at one ethnic group in the urban community. It's a sizable section of the urban community that feels disenfranchised from mainstream development, and they really don't have a say in local development, you know. And as a result, we are seeing a lot of local government issues being then translated as unhappiness at the higher level. So while I believe if government at the federal level looks at, for example, a revisit to a Royal Commission report that was there, which is forgotten, the Adinapan report on local government elections, I think a lot of issues would be settled if we revamp local government, increase participatory development, let local people decide what are the priorities in their neighborhoods. This also has an impact to small towns, you know. Small town development, like outskirts between KL and Slim River or Ipoh, then you've got a lot of small towns that are in many ways lacking young people's vibrancy, or industries are not there, and a lot of small towns are actually suffering because of the growth models that we have put in. So there's high growth in Klang Valley, Kinta Valley, Penang Prai area, Johor, and things of this sort. But smaller towns in between, and lot of idle land because of the underemphasis on agriculture and actually modernizing agriculture. And so getting the poor to participate in this process requires moving away from top-down, heavy bureaucratic approaches to people empowerment.
And you mentioned earlier Vision 2020. Before we look ahead, let's take a look back. The late Tunku Abdul Rahman wrote a letter to your father in 1962 after he helped register 7,000 Indians to become Malaysian citizens. Tunku wrote, "There is no finer expression of love and loyalty to our country than the act of becoming a citizen. Whether we are born here or whether we were born elsewhere and have come to Malaya to live and work here and make a home as citizens, we are all Malayan together, linked in unity to make Malaya a nation in which we can all live and be happy." Almost 60 years after that letter, is our nation drifting further away from this sentiment?
I think it's quite outstanding. Actually, this letter was discovered only a few years ago. And when I discovered it, it was a 50-year-old letter. I missed it when I did a book on my dad to add this letter, because it was discovered much later. But I think the sentiments expressed by Tunku on the value, if we look at it, whether you are born here or whether you are born elsewhere, we are all Malayans because we have become citizens. I think this is quite in contrast to a lot of people, sections of our society that have been saying, oh, you are not a loyal citizen, you are not this or that, or, you know, you are a pendatang and things like that. I think Tunku appreciated and people felt the sense of belonging to the nation. Now, if I took my grandfather actually only stayed in two places in the district of Kuala Langat. He never returned back to Sri Lanka. And if one looked at that, he was in Bacalaut and in Teluk Panglimagarang. Likewise, my father was more like a local town, community leader and local politician. So if we look at these themes of citizenship, I think people valued the sense of belonging. And this is why a lot of red IC holders who might be 60 or 70 or 80 year old want a blue IC, because they want to die believing they have made this their home. And so citizenship, which is then guaranteed in the federal constitution, not only rights but responsibilities, is something inherent in becoming a citizen, and this is our home. So if one took my grandfather, who came in 1910, and we are now looking at over 100 years my family has been here, with my dad local born, I'm local born, my children are local born, and my first grandchild is on the way, then we are looking at five generations. And one cannot then say, you know, your roots is somewhere else, because this is the only land that we know. And we are truly, and Tunku then brings the theme, because this was 1962. And so he brings the term, you are a Malayan, and a sense of belonging to the land. And it's a very powerful letter. And that is why on page 20 of my book, I published the letter. And actually, there is a, you know, a real historical photo, because when Tunku visited my hometown, and I was then 14 years old, he came to the Dewan Orang Ramai in Banting Town, next to the UMNO building, and my dad took me to this event. And when Tunku and other political leaders on stage were having tea, I don't know what courage came on to me, but I walked up to the stage. Maybe security was not that strong then, and stood by the side of Tunku and got this autograph, which is also on page 12 of my book. And at that time, the local cameraman took a photo, which I think is a real historical photo, which he sold to my dad. And that captures the essence of a 14-year-old young man standing by the side of Tunku, who was having tea, and he graciously signed. And I kept that piece of paper till to this day, because it's something that you value from Bapa Merdeka.
I'm speaking today to Dr. Denison Jayasuriya, sociologist, social advocate, and also co-author of Faith in Society, My Life Journey and Thoughts, a book which we are discussing today. Coming up, we find out more about the book, as well as the role of public academics in forming a civil society, on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, joined today by Dr. Denison Jayasuriya, Principal Research Fellow at the Institute of Ethnic Studies at UKM and Secretary General of PROHAM. Also, most recently, the co-author of Faith in Society, My Life Journey and Thoughts, which is the book that we're discussing today, alongside some of Dr. Denison's views on academics and forming a civil society. So, Dr. Denison, we've talked a little bit about the importance of citizenship. Now, something that comes up very often in any discussion of Malaysia, sadly, is still the idea of race. How do you think we're doing, and what else can we be doing in order to move away from race-based rhetoric towards a race-free society?
Okay. I think one cannot run away from the sense of identity. So ethnicity is one defining indicator of an identity of a person. So one could be Indian, or it could be a sub-ethnic section like the Malay community. You could have a hereditary from the Bugis or Javanese or a mixed kind of heritage, and likewise the Chinese. So you cannot run away from ethnicity, but in most ways, all of us have multiple identities. So race should not be the only consideration in the way one is defined. So we cannot run away from the color of our skin, but the color of the skin should not make us feel that we are superior or made to feel inferior in society. Because the Federal Constitution makes it very clear that Article 8 of the Federal Constitution is the equality of all citizens in the land. So having said that, there are different people within society and in the world as well who highlight or hype up race or racial sentiments because it's the easiest. Race and religion actually pushes people to do things that the rational person will not do. And often, if information is controlled, if there is lack of access to alternative views, then one can be grilled, literally brainwashed, or pushed to a corner to look at things all from a racial paradigm. And I think that's wrong. And Malaysian society has both the good and the ugly side, where some push race and religion to a very extreme in the sense here, not I'm you know, we are all against any form of violence and militancy or terrorism, but extreme in the sense it becomes exclusive to such a point that you look down at someone or do not want to associate or distrust someone because of color or religion or language and things of that sort. That is dehumanizing, and that is unacceptable in the global sense of the word, as well as so. It's exclusion comes. It could come from a class dimension. It could come from a gender dimension. It could come from ability, disability dimension or impairments. But I think this is where we need to build an inclusive society. While it might sound rhetorical, but at the same time, we must have public policies in place that will not segregate us or separate us or institute things that will make you feel that you are a second-class citizen or you're a superior citizen. I think in many ways, income levels tend to show that. I mean, if you are in a Mercedes, if you are living in a huge bungalow, you have a lot of cash, and somebody who doesn't have anything, the sense of alienation comes from a class divide. But you might have all the money and the resources, but you might then be feeling a sense of alienation because of your color or you are being deprived. And I think this is where both the Federal Constitution, and we need to set up mechanisms to address any form of discrimination that is unlawful and not acceptable.
In your book, you mentioned the important role that teachers have played in your life. Yes. What should we do to improve our education system or to maintain the high levels, of good teachers that we see or that we've enjoyed? Because, again, this is something that comes up often. While teachers are generally acknowledged as incredibly important in young lives, the quality of teaching is something that's come up.
I think if one looked back, I came from a very small town, Banting in Kuala Langat, and I just went to the normal school, both primary and secondary. And I must say, I didn't do well at both primary and secondary levels. I couldn't qualify to a government Form 6 program, and I went to a private Vento Academy, and I couldn't qualify to University Malaya or any local university, and I then went off to India to do undergraduate work. But subsequently, over time, managed to secure the Chevening Scholarship and managed to do my PhD work in the United Kingdom. But having said that, I think it's the foundation. Teachers were really role models. They were strict. The way the Methodist school, both the primary and the secondary that was run, I still am in contact. Only on Saturday evening, I visited my principal, Mr. Vincent Daniel, and his wife, who was my Standard 6 teacher, to present to them a copy of my book, because I've been so grateful to their impact on my life. So I think it's true. Teachers are sort of the guide that we need. Unfortunately, I think in the type of development we have gone on, some sections of the best people in our society have not taken on teaching as the profession. So I think people are then being pushed or streamlined at some sense to say, okay, you're a good student, then you are into the sciences, you're not into the arts and things of that sort. And then you're pushed into different career choices. But teachers, especially at primary school and secondary school, must be the best people or high grade graders to actually guide. And there must be a sense of calling to teaching. And I think the Ministry of Education, I sit now on the National Education Advisory Council with the blueprint in place, with the research that the Ministry of Education is doing. I think there is tremendous consciousness of the struggles and the issues faced, and much attempts are being taken. But I don't think it's just the government role. It's also the total community and ensuring that merit, promotions, recognition, remuneration, freedom, teaching styles, I think need to be in balance. And so the quality improvement needs to take place, because a lot of the rich and affluent are moving into private education, into international schools that have been liberalized. And this will definitely create a class divide in our society. But I think it's the schools that are central to my own development, and in that context, to how we want the nation to be built as well.
Going beyond just schools and universities, what is the role of a public intellectual in public discourse? Is there even a space for an intellectual class to dialogue?
Yes. I think the struggle now for many academics, now with the clampdown using the Sedition Act or earlier through other restrictive means, there must be space and freedom for intellectual development. There must be the safe space for people to express, people to question, people to have the learning space. I have always had that opportunity to work within various policy institutions, and I write about this, whether it was the National Economic Consultative Council, to whether it was the Police Commission, whether it was the Human Rights Commission, and I'm now part of the NUCC, National Unity Consultative Council. I think it's an opportunity for people to articulate the concerns of society, to hear the voices of the rakyat, as it were, and to translate them into concepts and areas, and try then to bring out recommendations and public policy analysis. I think there's the space for it, but often researchers and academics are caught in writing in journals or in books rather than expressing in public. And for that, you need a freer media and freer and more talk shows and opportunities to articulate and the respect for alternative views. And I think we need to shift from a climate of fear to talk or to be reprimanded or to be fearful that you might not get your promotions, to a culture that is argumentative.
And allowed to question itself.
And question it. And within that framework, the argumentative Malaysian must emerge. I think we tend to be very Asian. When I went to Oxford, Brookes University, the major struggle the lecturers or my professors were having with me was I wasn't questioning them, because in a PhD program, you need to tear up the arguments of the best professor and take it to the next stage. And that's part of learning, questioning, critical thinking. Now, if you cannot critically think of what's happening or what a politician is saying or what your headmaster is saying or your teacher is saying, if the student is said, you keep quiet and listen, I know what's best, and that will not generate. And this is where public intellectuals need to emerge, that they might be academic or they are knowledgeable, they are full of wisdom and experience, and they are brave enough to voice out and highlight the negativity, the positivity, and lead the country forward. And that, I believe, is the citizen's right as well as responsibility. And by remaining silent or non-expressive, we fail in our duty, and the nation might go in the wrong way.
Is the role of the public intellectual to facilitate that space for more citizens to speak up, or is it perhaps more to represent certain segments of society?
I think both can be. I think in some way creativity and creating the space is through one's writings. And people could write in the internet, they could write articles, they could write books, they could write in journals, they can make it academic, they can make it popular, they can be critical, but they have to be cautious that they're not seditious or be pinpointed in that way. And as a result, there is this balancing role. But I think this is where more academics, especially those in politics, economics, law, need to emerge. But often they are then seen as anti-establishment and failing to realize that you might agree with someone on a point A, but you might disagree with that point on point B or C. And so I think we must be able to speak our mind in a way with respect, with consideration, but without compromising the truth and without acting in a way that will jeopardize the nation.
We have a tweet from Natusha Naidu who says, I think we make this intellectual space more limited due to the growing attitude of elitism and snobbery. It's not just the law. What is your view on that? Because I think for many people, the idea of intellectualism and academia, it does have that ring to it of snobbery and, you know, of not perhaps representing the views of the many.
I think it depends. In what I'm trying to emphasize, the public intellectual is someone, like in my case, I'm coming from sociology or anthropology background. So our methodology is to gather the views of the grassroots and then represent it in a way that can be articulated for public policy. One could have an ivory tower approach to academia, and that could be an issue. Or one could have a very high-class view of this, so you do not want to take up the concerns of the poor, the real marginalized, because that's going to affect your own standing. So you might want... So some researchers might cite alongside a big timber company and do some environmental program that might undermine the position of indigenous people. Or you might work with a plantation company on doing technology and agriculture and crop or fertilizer but then neglecting that. So there could be those dimensions, but the point of public intellectual is one who is on behalf of society, working not for, but alongside with the poor in a participatory, participant observation approach, being involved with the people and standing alongside. And that's why that type of action research is not as popular, because you might not be standing with the rich and powerful. You have to move with those that might be disadvantaged and, you know, and neglected.
And finally, what is your vision for Malaysia? You know, how can we all foster a faith in society?
I think the critical aspect that I'm looking at, and my book actually concludes in chapter 20 with my vision for Malaysia, and I make a simple reminder to the 9 challenges that Dr. Mahathir brought out in Vision 2020, and we are only 6 years away from that, that if we keep in central focus and balance the federal constitution in its core principles, in the balance that the federal constitution highlights and Rukun Negara, and take the 9 challenges, then tolerant society, matured liberal, caring, commitment to democracy, people's participation, economically just society, then I think we are reaching it. I think somewhere along the line, those in government and in positions of high public policy have not actually looked at the 9 challenges to then see. If the overemphasis is just on income and economic growth, then we lose out, because moral and ethical society, mature democratic society, what does that mean? In a mature democracy, can you still have preventive detention? Can you still have a sedition act and these sort of things? Or do you give greater space for the media, for check and balance, for greater accountability of leaders? And that then comes with other aspects of the challenge. So I think that's the point that I'm highlighting, that one needs to build a society with a sense of respect for the other. We cannot build Malaysia just by one ethnic community despising another. We need to work together. It's just not one or 3 communities. It's much bigger than that. It's Malay, Chinese, Indian, Sabahan, Sarawakian, Orang Asli. So if we look at the tremendous diversity and richness, it's taking that. It might sound too idealistic, but we then need the mechanisms in place to check abusers, address the grievances, ensure there is social inclusion, there is effective monitoring and impact assessment to measure this. We need to introduce a greater level of professionalism in the way we are doing a social impact assessment, even national unity impact assessment, rather than getting caught in the rhetorics or being pulled by one group or the other using political bargaining in a negative way, which is taking place daily in the media and in the lobbying that's taking place. So I think we need to realize that we need every Malaysian to build it, and that we must be more gracious to one another, recognizing history, background, and that together we will be able to build this land and make this far more richer and prosperous and inclusive alongside, and not forgetting justice and rights in the process.
Faith in Society, My Life Journey and Thoughts by Datuk Dr. Denison Jayasuriya is available at select MPH bookstores as well as mphonline.com. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking to Datuk Dr. Denison Jayasuriya, sociologist, social advocate and co-author of Faith in Society, My Life Journey and Thoughts on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.